No, that might be all right.
So that's you. How about me?
Good, good, good.
I am also good.
You are good.
Excellent.
Just don't touch the power button this time.
Right.
Because that shuts us both off.
No flicking the power button. Gotcha. Yes.
technology.
I've learned from last time.
Welcome back to another episode of Scouting Stuff. Almost said Scouting 5, but this is not that.
No, this is not that.
This is the other one.
Yes.
Yes. As you can hear, you've got two of us this evening. Scouter Colin is again in front of the mic.
Hello.
Hello. And of course, I am Scouter Ken. Finally got back in touch. It's been a little
while. You know, life.
Yeah.
Doing life things.
When you were crazy busy at work, apparently.
Yes. I had my own... little project going on
where,
as part of the ever-growing diversification process of our company. We're trying to put our systems on other pieces of equipment.
And as you do.
So most recently, I put a load sensor on a material handler.
Huh.
For those of you that don't know what a material handler is.
I was about to say.
It is a excavator style, so it's got, you know, the for those that don't know what an excavator is, I guess I keep using these.
If there are any 3 or 4 year olds in the audience, I'm fairly certain that the colloquial term is digger.
Yes.
Yes.
So I'm glad you're here too. I thought that was the vernacular for the little guys, but uh-oh. I'm not sure. So it's a digger, but... You know, instead of having a digging bucket, it's got a grapple like you would see in, I'm going to date myself again. You know, Toy Story when they had the claw? The claw.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
Yeah. You and I get that reference. There might be some people that don't get that reference.
My kids have seen Toy Story.
Okay. Then, well, you're... I was going to say cultured.
Yeah, well, maybe, yes. I don't know. That's a stretch.
Although Pixar is quite good. So yeah.
Yes.
Anyways, it's essentially
some sort of grabber.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you find them in scrap metal recycling places.
Okay.
So yeah, they're busy trundling around the yard, loading rail cars or loading semis or whatever to move shredded metal from point A to point B.
Hmm. I could see the application for, you know, load monitoring.
Yes. Yeah. It helps the guys running the show to kind of have a ballpark figure.
Hmm.
I mean, our stuff isn't exactly transportation certified. Like, it's not weights and measures. You're not...
Right. You're not...
You're not using it for legal purposes. You're using it for safety purposes. And also, you know, at least it gives you a ballpark figure of, you know, if you're...
You can get a rough idea of the tonnage you're moving around.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
So.
That works.
We're trying it out.
See, hey, why not?
And so far, the feedback has been pretty positive. Note to self, if changing like machines, always make sure the dimensions are the same.
Can't always count on that.
No. It's weird.
Yeah.
You'd think people would design equipment when they say it's the same model, that it would be the same. But
when you're building at that scale, though, I imagine that there's a certain
plus
variance.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So, but anyways, yeah, that's been my last month anyways. And couple that with some other, you know, life stuff. I mean... we pulled out our garden just recently, so there's a lot of tomatoes and a lot of carrots and, you know, cucumber and various other things. So
yep.
My house has been a mix of making pasta sauces and salsas and canning things.
Yes.
And pickling things. And yeah,
I got a fridge full of preserves downstairs.
I'm getting ready for, pickling carrots.
The next step.
Yes. I don't know. Do you enjoy a good pickled carrot?
I do, but carrots are just a thing that are not a thing in our household because I'm literally the only one out of the six of us who can eat them.
Right.
Everybody else breaks out.
I gotcha.
So it's a thing that I've not had in some time, but I do enjoy them. But, you know, I mean, I also like just a nice straight up pickle.
Yes.
Although, of course, pickling is itself a challenge when you're dealing with a corn allergy in the house, because what is most vinegar made from but corn?
Yes.
Apple cider vinegar, though, is not.
Hmm.
And sometimes certain wine vinegars are also safe for my wife to use.
Oh, that's good. At least there's some options.
Yes. So it means we have to be a little bit more creative on our feet when we're canning stuff that requires any sort of vinegar additive. But that did not slow us down at all. And like I say, there's a fridge full downstairs to attest to just how productive the garden was. Yeah, we don't grow carrots. We grew a fair number of tomatoes.
Yeah. Let's compare.
Yeah. A few cucumbers. A lot of tomatoes, actually.
We had 41 plants at our house.
Oh, yeah. We don't have anywhere near that many.
So we were the, I won't say the, because our house backs onto a path in our neighborhood, and it's a pretty major path.
Yeah.
So we get a lot of unsolicited advice on how to garden.
Oh, I was going to say you probably get a lot of unexpected product loss.
Well, no, actually, it's surprisingly. Everyone's been pretty good. Like, I figured that would have been a thing. But no, what we get more often than not is the unsolicited advice on how to grow tomatoes or how to grow corn or how to grow carrots or whatever, right? It's just...
Well, I mean, if you've never done it before, it is they are all very different plants to grow. But.
Yes, and we have learned from our first year to our second year. So, you know,
I always
advice is always I won't say advice is always welcome, but you should always ask if you can provide it, as opposed to just launching into you know what you need.
yeah, exactly.
That usually has a negative reaction in our household.
I always remember, just speaking of tomatoes, my favorite story from within my family was still the I don't know, bitterness is not the right word, but my mom and her brother, now he has since passed away, but my mom had been growing tomatoes for many a year, and her brother decided one year that he was going to give this a try. And of course, so like my mom would typically just buy tomato plants and plant them, and that would be fine. But her brother decided that he was going to grow them from seed.
Ooh.
Yeah. His plants turned out better and produced more. And so there was a certain amount of put outedness that happened.
Yes, I would I would imagine that would have been a thing.
So. Yeah. So, but I mean, we grow ours from seed. You know, you start them in like March and whatever else.
Yeah.
You got a whole bunch of cups of potato.
Grown
inside
the spectrum, the UV spectrum light.
No, we just have a nice. We just have stuff that lives in the back window there.
Oh, and just in the windowsill. Well, that's still good. Yeah, we have, just because we
have... My mom has the UV light set up.
Sorry?
My mom has a UV light set up.
Yes.
Yeah.
No, we have UV lights at our place, but it's because we have cats, and the room that we don't let the cats into is a dark room.
Ah,
it doesn't get a lot of direct sunlight.
Fair enough,
So you kind of have to...
You make do. You
make
improvise.
Do. Yeah. But what we do run with in the wintertime is we actually grow heads of lettuce while we're...
Oh, yeah, I guess that would work.
So you can actually have a little greenery in your, you know, like for salads and things like that. And it actually works quite well.
Not bad. Yeah, we try and keep some herbs growing year-round. Mm-hmm. It doesn't always work, but sometimes. Yeah. Well... So, thank you for tuning into gardening stuff. You should
gardening stuff. You should know. Well,
tangent. it is. Well, tangent. We started with a tangent. It'll be the tangent when we get back to topic. Right?
Yeah.
Topic shift. But I mean, like, you know, like it's funny too because you know this is definitely, you know, a big part of you know, and especially you and I coming out of, like, you know, the Ukrainian cultural element or just the Slavic cultural element in the province, it was a huge thing, right? I mean, gosh, I can remember grandma had like literally hundreds of jars and just so many of those, the rubber rings, right?
Yeah.
You know, these days they're integrated into the little lid piece.
Oh, but, okay.
You know, at least like that's the kind that we get.
Those are the can, the jarring.
Yeah.
So that I think you get.
It's just up there actually.
Oh yeah.
But we're recording this in my garage because, you know, why not? Change of scenery.
Yeah, why not?
That and, yeah, apparently we're too loud when we're on the deck. So, whatever. But, yeah, I mean, like, it's just, it's a big part of the culture around here, right?
Mm-hmm.
And kind of necessarily so, right? Like, I mean, you think about, you know, sort of the how Alberta was settled, right? And just, you have a short growing season, and then you have months and months of occasionally quite brutal winters.
Yeah.
So you kind of do need to have that cycle of, or at least, you know, the initial settlers here had to have that cycle of, you know, you grow.
Yeah.
And then you preserve as much as you can and hope that you can just kind of ride that supply through the months where nothing grows and the ground is frozen. And I mean, obviously in this modern age, that's not as much of a concern, although as we kind of saw last year, occasionally the supply side of the equation falls over.
Yeah, there's that the unknown element that can run or wreak havoc on your supply chain.
Yeah, so anyways, but fun stuff. I've just been wrapping up work projects as well. And, of course, now getting back to actually being able to do coursework, because we're supposed to do yearly, like, courses and certifications for the work that I do. Mm-hmm. And this is actually, I've been chomping at the bit to do this one, because this is a digital forensics course and then an accompanying certification. So looking forward to getting that one, especially because, like, one of our newer product lines is incident monitoring and incident response for the industrial control environments that we service. And I mean, it's still very fledgling and it's really mostly on the monitoring side. The response side is further down the road, but at some point, you know, when that tech does detect suspicious activity coming out of what it's monitoring within a client environment, we're going to need boots on the ground people. You know, trained incident handlers and trained forensic techs. And I mean, I've been messing around and dabbling with that stuff for a few years now. It's actually really quite fascinating.
Yeah.
To, you know, when you talk about, like, you know, some of the, usually the glitzier side of cybersecurity is the pen testing and the people who do the hacking stuff. And forensics is kind of on the other side of that, right? This is the, okay, how'd you get in? What'd you break? How'd you break it?
Yeah.
How do I stop you? which I find actually really quite fun. So looking forward to that. But, although, tomorrow, road trip, client site.
Yay.
Yeah, well.
Part of the job.
It is. So, anyways.
What did you have in mind, sir?
Well, so this was actually, okay, do you remember when you were experimenting with angel food cakes?
Oh, yes.
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 And do you remember, now, I don't know.
You mean angel pound cakes?
Well, the first couple were. Well, it's because we got the yolk. Well, that
who knew that a little bit of yolk in an egg white would do so much?
Yeah, even like just the tiniest drop of egg yolk in your 12 egg whites, and all of a sudden your angel food cake is not so light and fluffy and risey anymore. It's still delicious.
But it tastes like angel food cake, but dense.
Yes, very dense. And I don't know, I mean, ultimately, like, you settled on using the boxed egg whites.
Yes.
But I don't know if you remember, you know, my wife's attempts to research whether this was a viable option for the baking of angel food cake.
Oh.
And her discovery that within the angel food cake community, because there is one.
Obviously. Why wouldn't there be?
This was a subject of great controversy.
Oh, I can only imagine the purists in the room
would
have you believe that.
Yes.
You must have egg weights from
us. We were greatly amused to see just how bent out of shape some people got at the thought of using cartoned egg whites in an angel food cake recipe. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, though, it proved to be quite effective.
It worked very well.
Yes. Certainly much better than, you know, separating a bunch of yolks by hand.
The person who the cake was for really enjoyed the cake. So I feel mission accomplished.
Yes. Myself. I would say that ultimately the proof is in the cake.
And yes.
There's your So funnily enough, turns out that there's a very easy way to wander into a not dissimilar scale of controversy in regards to a lot of different pieces of equipment, but in particular, what I started to, because, so we were a couple of weeks ago wrapping up a handful of permits with some of the scouts.
Okay.
And there was one kid who had to get, he had a couple of things left to do for his stove and lantern permit.
Okay.
And it got me thinking that, you know, like, I mean, we've been using white gas stoves since ever.
Mm-hmm. I mean, but that's the only, in our frame of mind, that's the only stove to, how else are you going to blow your eyebrows off?
Right. I mean, like that one up there is a propane, which doesn't have nearly the same sort of eruptive quality as a white gas burner. Actually over there, there's a butane. Not that little grill thing there, but kind of in behind it, there's a black plastic case, and that's a butane stove. Mm. And that got me thinking, which of these is the best?
Yeah.
And that's already kind of a loaded question because I learned two things very quickly. One, this is there's a great deal of controversy around this. If you go looking for it online, you will find nothing but endless debates about, naphtha, a.k.a. white gas, versus propane, versus butane. But then also, ultimately, you know, kind of what I found, and this was, there was one website called Decide Outside that sort of really took a different approach on this, as opposed to just a straight up debate, which was, you know, ultimately, it kind of comes down to what you're trying to do, right? Mm-hmm. So, yeah, anyways, I thought that we would, and I mean, I'll probably kind of use their article as a guide because they went through it for a bunch of different categories, some of which are particularly relevant in the, shall we say, Canadian context.
Yes.
I.e. cold tolerance.
Yes. I was going to say, that is a big one. Like if you were to do some winter camping, or if winter camping was in your wheelhouse,
And certainly we've done that.
Yeah. No, I think that is the reason why we did naphtha stoves is because they work well in cold. Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then some of the other categories that they looked at were availability, the ease of storage, burn efficiency, you know, so how much heat you get for how long, for how much weight of fuel.
Right.
Cost effectiveness, weight, and then, of course, cleanliness. So, you know, carbon and other byproducts of burning.
So out of curiosity, I mean, you have a couple of different stoves here. Like, you know, do you have a preference off the top?
So for myself, I've kind of largely gone over to propane because my two mains are the two burner camp stove just up there.
Yeah.
And then also that little grill unit over there tucked in behind the water jug. Mm-hmm. And both of those are propane units.
Okay.
And it's nice that I can just, you know, have two or three canisters and I can use it with all of it. And there's really no fuss, right?
Yeah. For me, I am a fan of propane for car camping. So like your spring, summer, fall camping out of the car. And the reason I say that is just because you can, like, the way I set up a campsite when I'm car camping is I have one of those big barbecue tanks and I have a Christmas tree off of it, or
a splitter.
A splitter, yeah. Essentially. Manifold, if we're getting technical.
Yes. Hey, earlier we were calling it a digger.
Yeah. Right. Well, we're helping educate.
There you go.
A splitter. Manifold. Anyways, so yeah, and on the top of that, you would put your lantern. Instead of screwing a bottle into it, you just screw it on top of this manifold, and then you park it beside the picnic table, and it throws the light.
Yep, and then you can set your stove up off of another link.
And, yeah, exactly, right? And if it's cold, then you can put a heater on that as well, and, you know, there's just...
Yeah.
There's some versatility there. So, but for the backpacking and the winter camping, I'd always gravitate towards the naphtha. But
yeah.
That's mostly because my accessibility to the other types of stoves, the butane, and maybe I wouldn't have like a one burner propane stove to utilize.
Yeah. Well, and so. I think too, like it does help to distinguish, you know, as you do between different styles of camping, right? Like,
yeah.
I think in a winter camp, I'd still probably be tempted to go towards propane just because if it's cold enough, I don't want to, you know, I would rather have something that lights fairly quickly versus something that I have, like something that has its own pressure versus something that I have to manually and then semi-continuously pressurize, right? Because that's the one disadvantage of the white gas is that you're periodically having to get down, fingers on cold metal, to pump it, prime it, and then keep it pressurized.
Yeah.
Now, to be fair, obviously, you take a propane tank out into minus 20, you are going to get diminished performance, right? That
it's not going to work as well.
The gas law is going to bite you in the butt. Yes. So you can get better gas pressure with the white gas. If you're willing to actually put in the manual effort.
Yeah.
But again, depending on how cold it is, that may not be the most appealing thing. And so there's a sort of a little bit of a trade-off that you have to work out for yourself there, whether you really want to. But that said...
butane's the other one. That
butane. And I don't think butane does very well at the lower temperatures either.
If lighters are any indication.
Butane's not a great low temperature thing.
No.
On the other hand... If I am going for, you know, essentially like the ultralight approach,
right.
Where, you know, I'm literally like, I have to be able to live out of my backpack, then, you know, having something like that butane stove up there, which there is a fuel canister in that case, right? It's a single burner stove canister, fuel canister is in the case with it. And it's very, very light, right? Mm-hmm. Butane's an excellent choice if you need to save every ounce of weight.
Yeah.
So it does help to distinguish between the kind of camping that you're going to do. I mean, if I'm not worried about temperature and say I'm just going to march into Burtonsville Island for a week and a weekend, maybe not a week, a weekend. Do I carry a gallon of white gas? Do I carry a small tank of propane? I'm not sure which ones.
Yeah. A liter of fuel a liter of fuel. That's liquid is going to be, it's going to have a different weight to it than, the gas, right?
Yeah.
In the same size container. Is that how that math works?
I was just thinking about it. Yeah, it's like PV equals NRT. Well, that's for gas.
Right.
Obviously liquids, so, it's a bit different.
It's different. It's just volume, but yeah, but at any rate, you know, it's like you said, the weight. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a weekend camp or whatever, you know, a liter of fuel will likely last you. Or, I guess.
It depends on how much you're using it for, and if you're using it for just cooking, or if there's lanterns involved too.
Yeah.
A small, easily carryable tank of propane, not like a full barbecue sized one. Right.
No.
There's like a quarter size one of those boxes up there.
Yeah.
That one would probably last.
The little cylinders.
Yeah. One would probably last fully. And I mean, filled up, it's going to weigh about as much as, you know, one of those metal jugs of white gas, anyways.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of availability, I guess propane probably has slightly wider availability than White Pass. Although if you're near a Canadian Tire, this is largely a moot point.
Exactly. You know? I was going to say, I've never had a problem.
Yeah.
Well, finding it in the city anyways.
I was gonna say, if you're driving down the highway and you need to refill on one or the other, you're probably going to find propane first.
Yeah.
Again, unless you drive past a Canadian Tire, at which point you can find just about anything you need.
Yeah.
Butane, for availability's sake, just like straight up butane, is a little bit less readily available. Again, unless you're going by, you know, if you go
Campers
by Mech
Village
or go by
Mech
Campers or, Village or Canadian Tire, right? But yeah, if you're just like driving down the highway and it's like, oh, shoot, I need to fill up. Well, the first gas station you pull in at, they're probably going to have propane.
Yeah. I was going to say the cylinders of propane, especially around a touristy areas, will have like tourist camping areas kind of thing.
Yep.
Your provincial campgrounds and whatnot. The gas station that's closest will inevitably have propane cylinders.
Yep.
But
or even like, you know, even if you want to get away from like, because yeah, those Coleman 1 pound cylinders are great. But even if you have just like a 15 pound cylinder, right? Very easy to find a refill for that. White Gas, you know, any hardware store, but certainly, you know, like I say, your C Tires are gonna have them.
Home Hardware, I guess.
Home Hardware might.
Yeah. I remember seeing like when we were out at Wabamun, that would, you know, you'd walk through the Home Hardware affiliate store there and it would be on the shelf.
Yeah. So. Walmart would probably carry it too. Some would, at any rate. Because they do have a small camping and outdoor section.
Yeah. I was going to say if it's a camping and outdoor section.
Yeah. So, again, now, I mean, fuel availability, you know, again, like that's sort of more of a concern for like, okay, I've been at this for a little while and I need a refill. That's where fuel availability, you know, if you're starting from, again, unless you're starting from like the middle of nowhere, if your start point is the middle of nowhere and you don't have a lot of options for where to go and buy fuel.
Yeah.
Okay. That's one thing, right? But for us, like, you know, starting from a camp in the middle of a city, I mean, we can basically find any kind of fuel we need. That's not really going to set us back. But, you know, I mean, it is, depending on the duration of trip, the availability of fuel and refuel is certainly important to keep in mind. You know, we talked a little bit about cold temperatures.
Yeah. Temperature in general.
Yeah. And it's funny too, because like this Decide Outside website, everything is compared against gasoline.
Okay.
You know, it's on the charts, right? And then they make this note. It's just like gasoline is the easiest to ignite in cold temperatures. Does not score so well on safety since it is so volatile.
Really?
Oh, weird, huh?
Tell me more. Yeah.
I can't think of any, camp stoves that run off of gasoline. I've never encountered one in my life. But I guess it is a useful standard for comparison because it is a very commonly available fuel.
Yeah.
You know, kind of, it's a known quantity, right?
Yeah, that'd be interesting. I'm trying to remember. There were the one burner stoves that Eric Lund had. Do you remember? Eric?
No, I remember Eric. I don't remember the stoves.
Oh.
I mean, are you talking about the little one-burner Coleman stoves? The White Gas stoves? No.
No, not those ones. I don't think. But they were like little fold-up. Sorry, I'm using hand signals to
like, were they the ones that came in those like sort of
it looked like a hamburger box almost.
Oh, no. Okay, I'm thinking of something
different. And you opened it up and you pulled out the burner was there. Then the little tank for it was like right there, like right beside the burner. It was, I need to, oh man.
Because like I have a little Coleman one burner up there.
Yeah.
Just in the little red bag. You can kind of just see
the same kind of thing where it's just the one burner backpacking stove. I've had that one forever.
Yeah.
It still works. And it's great. Yeah.
Well, that's the nice thing about the Coleman stove. They tend not to die.
And they're actually, like for me, if I'm going on a road trip of some sort, I don't mind actually throwing it in the vehicle with me, because if you want to have a stop on the side of the road and warm up something or make yourself a hot beverage or whatever, it is pretty convenient that way and takes up very little space. Well, Yes, that's subjective.
Yeah. Well,
in my world, it takes up a little bit of, it takes up very little space. In somebody's world, it's probably big and bulky.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Right. Like, it's, again, we all have a standard that we're playing to.
That subjective field.
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, just again, looking at the site here, this Decide Outside site, they actually do kind of get into like white gas cold tolerance. And of course, again, compared to gasoline, like gasoline has a very, very, very low temperature flash point. Minus 50 Fahrenheit.
Oh, okay.
Not quite sure what that is in Celsius, but darn cold.
It is colder than minus 40.
Yes. Funnily enough, white gas's flash point is about 0 Fahrenheit.
Oh.
So if you get it into temperatures, and again, sorry, it is in Fahrenheit. I'd convert it, but I don't want to go away from the website right now.
It's that's, 0 Fahrenheit.
Yeah, that's still darn cold. Like that's in that the minus 20s ish. Yeah. Yeah. But then if you get below that, now you're below the flash point and you're not going to have much fun trying to light that, which by the way is where butane and isobutane start to fail you because their vaporization point, which, you know, fundamental, like that's where, so a little bit of a difference between flash point and vaporization point, right? Mm-hmm. Flash point is where a liquid fuel will ignite.
Right.
Vaporization point is where a gaseous fuel will turn to liquid and fail to ignite.
Yeah.
So butane will vaporize at 31 Fahrenheit, so just below zero Celsius. Isobutane, 11 Fahrenheit. So you're getting into your, just into your double digit minus Celsius's.
Yep.
And then propane is minus 43.
I think that's why I like, I could be wrong, but I feel like that's the reason why I like naphtha stoves, or it's because of the way they're designed, right? You pressurize it, and then once you get it lit, yes, there might be a flame there, but it actually heats up the...
Yes, it heats up the fuel nearby.
So that heat exchanger, right? Like it provides heat to vaporize the fuel that's coming in.
Yes.
Ergo, a better burn and
So if you can get it lit, then it will kind of just take care of itself past that point.
Yes. Yeah. Now I don't know if the propane and the butane stoves are similarly designed. I don't think so. Like, from what I remember of them.
The propane stoves aren't. Like, it's just they simply inject it on the side.
And yeah,
it
goes, it's just to the burners. A burner.
And you're not actually putting that fuel pipe across one of the burners.
That's right.
And ditto, I think, for the butane stoves. Mm. Then again, too, the fuel ideally is already vaporized, so you don't have to worry about vaporizing it in the chamber.
As soon as you open it, as soon as you open the valve to ambient, it vaporizes.
Yeah, you're ideally already getting a gas out of the tank.
Yes.
So you
don't have to worry about that.
Skip that step. Unless, of course, it's, in the case of butane, just below 0 Celsius, or in the case of propane... Too cold to be camping outdoors anyways.
Yeah. Why are you camping?
Yeah, it's minus 43. Get inside.
Yeah. And try camping at a different time.
Yeah. Now, this is another one that's kind of worth thinking about too. Another category that they look at is storage longevity.
Ah.
And this is an interesting one because here it flips a little bit. And actually, I've noticed this too. You know, gasoline does not store well.
That is correct.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyone that has had a large jerry can of regular gas sit in their shed for a couple of years and then use it in a lawnmower will know the pain of of old gas.
Yes, it's not good. Now, fortunately, propane, isobutane, butane seem to store the best. And white gas comes in very close behind. Mm. So at least in that sense, you know, you're not really, you know, if you're looking for like absolute maximum storage lifetime, yeah, propane will probably be it.
Yeah.
Because as long as you don't have a slow leak.
Yes.
Pressure is pressure.
That's right.
Stay pressurized.
Yep.
And, you know, white gas, I mean, in theory, you should be able to keep propane indefinitely. And technically the butanes as well, as long as they don't. Mm-hmm. Vaporize, as long as they don't fall below the vapor point and turn to liquid.
Right.
Storing liquid fuels, white gas is more refined. So even if you have like a 5-year-old can of camp gas, mm-hmm. you might be able to get a decent flame off of it, right?
Yep.
You know, like you say, try that with, you know, 2-year-old gasoline and, well, once you've changed out the motor on your lawnmower,
yeah,
let us know how that worked for you.
Exactly. Right.
Yes. So, now, but for some groups, that may be a consideration, right? You know, if you're mm-hmm. storing, if you have like a group trove of fuel, mm-hmm. you know, if you're storing camp fuel, I mean, if you're going with propane or if you're going with white gas, those are both good choices with the caveat that, you know, yeah, if you do have white gas stored, you're mm-hmm. going to want to make sure that you're cycling through the supply in under 5 years.
Yeah.
Probably not a problem in most cases, but you know what? It's
better safe than...
Yeah, it's a thing worth taking note of.
Gumming up the works.
Yep. And then, of course, the cleanliness of burn. Generally speaking, the gaseous fuels burn mm-hmm. cleanest.
Yes.
So your propanes, your butanes. Alcohol burns a little cleaner than white gas, mm-hmm. and white gas burns cleaner than kerosene or gasoline. Mm-hmm. So... if you want to, you know, if the environmentally conscious angle of this is important to you, then mm-hmm. looking at
propane or butane. Yeah.
And then, of course, it just comes down to weight. And we kind of already touched on that a little bit because, of course, but it really, it's going to vary, right? If you are looking to have, you know, and like here, honestly, I am a bit torn, right? Because like, it's not terribly difficult to throw a couple of 1-pound canisters mm-hmm. into a backpack. Mm-hmm. And I mean, they're a little bulky, but you know, a couple pounds of propane is not much if you're packing light. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, just like a small one burner stove is not a big deal. Equally, you can get small canisters of white gas. And then there's those little one burner Colemans
yep.
that are quite excellent.
Yep.
If you absolutely need the weight savings, as we said, the butane might be your best option. Mm-hmm. 'cause you can get a lot of really great ultralight stuff that runs off of butane, and butane itself is quite light. Mm-hmm. Just don't take it out in the cold.
That's right.
But that was actually, funnily enough, that was where I found the most debate when I went looking online, and I'll post a couple of links to some of the other discussions that I tripped over. Mm-hmm. But you even had people like comparing the ease of dealing with empties, right?
Oh yeah.
It's like, and I mean, like, it's not, you know, yeah, I got to take those empties to, actually, I got a few over there in a bucket that I got to take to an eco station at some point here right. soon, right? So right. dealing with the empty propane
it's a thing.
Is yeah. a thing, yeah. but there is a way to deal with them. Mm-hmm. But no, they were, you know, there was one comment that someone made on one of these discussions. It's just like, with the white gas, like once the canister is empty, you can literally just like flatten it, right? Mm-hmm. And it goes down to nothing, right? Whereas the propane mm-hmm. still, the propane tanks still have weight to them, significant weight mm-hmm. to them, even after they're empty. That's not an invalid point, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure it's a make or break argument. It's not an invalid point, though. Those yeah. white gas canisters do, like once they're empty, there's not much canister there, and they can be flattened out if you need to save on
yeah.
the actual volume that you're using in your backpack.
Yeah.
Again, I'm not sure that's like the be all and end all of arguments, but it's something to consider.
Although I don't know if I'd be wanting to take fuel in a container that I can flatten after I'm done with it.
Well,
yeah, personal choices, I guess.
I guess. So yeah, I mean that, and ultimately, you know, if it's a larger supply, right, then yeah, you could have your gallon of white gas is going to last you a long time for a lot of applications at camp. You're going to be able to do lanterns with that. You're going to be able to do stoves with that. It's going to last you mm-hmm. easily for the weekend versus, you know, I mean, a 1-pounder tank probably wouldn't last you for the whole weekend if you're using, well, and the other thing too, I guess the one real advantage of, you know, say, even a liter of white gas over a couple 1-pounders of propane is that white gas fuel. That's not directly connected to what's being lit, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Your stove has its own tank. Your lantern has its own tank. Mm-hmm. Whatever else you're using it for has its own tank. Mm-hmm. And so if whereas if I have one of those 1-pounders, yeah. I can turn on one thing at a time, right?
Yeah.
I can have a stove or a lantern
Or both. I need two tanks.
Yeah, or I need two tanks.
Yeah.
Or I need a larger tank with a manifold.
Yeah.
So certainly in terms of, I think, the overall versatility, you could make an argument there that white gas wins out because, again, you have your white gas fuel canister or fuel supply, but it is just being used to top up the actual fuel reservoirs on each thing that it is fueling, right? Versus the propane where you're hooking it up directly to the thing that is using it. And so you're kind of limiting. It's like, okay, I have this fuel supply of propane and I'm automatically limited in its use to, you know, whatever I need it for in the immediate sense.
Yeah.
So I guess certainly that's a big feather in white gas's cap is that, you know, you could have two or three stoves going and a lantern off of essentially just 1 gallon of white gas or one of those, you know, cans of white gas that you can pick up.
Yeah.
And you can kind of run the whole show with just that supply.
Yep.
Whereas that's a fair bit of propane that you need to tank in otherwise. And also butane would have similar limitations, right? Your butane tank can hook up to one thing at a time. And butane actually is even more limited in that regard because there ain't no, at least I'm not aware of any 15-pound butane tanks that have a manifold on them.
Again, but it all depends. Yeah, I think we kind of circle back around to, not necessarily form versus function, but it's like, you know, location. Or what your application,
yeah, application would be the better
application over because functionally they all do the same job. Yes. They
you're lighting something on fire.
you're providing fuel to light something, so you either get light or you get heat for cooking. So,
yeah. So, and honestly, just the bit about the ability of a single source of camp gas to be able to fuel up, a few stoves and a lantern, like that literally just kind of hit me off the top of my head just now. I don't think it was something that was discussed, on the Decide Outside article. But again, like that's a relevant thing for a scout camp, right?
Because
you do, if your group has its own equipment base, then, and I mean, obviously if your group doesn't have its own equipment, if everybody coming on camp has to bring their own stuff, this is all a moot point anyways, because they just bring what they bring and,
you don't worry about it.
Hopefully they brought enough fuel for whatever it is they have.
Yeah, exactly.
But for something like our group where we do have a supply of gear, then and we do have several white gas stoves and white gas lanterns. And so I guess I should clarify that when I say white gas and camp gas, I'm talking about the same thing. It's naphtha fuel.
Yeah.
The Coleman camp gas, as it were. And so, yeah, when you have a bunch of different things that run off of this same thing, then, I mean, you can carry in a 15-pound propane tank.
Yeah.
And maybe you can split that off to two or three things at once. Or you can carry in a gallon of white gas and you can power however many stoves you need to.
Right. Well, it's just,
So I guess in terms of like for the maximum versatility, packing the liquid fuel, the naphtha, probably you can take that the farthest. But again, it works in the cold. It works quite well in the cold.
Yeah.
But again, like that's, and I think that's where, there is just that, momentary discomfort or maybe not momentary discomfort of, I'm going to take my gloves off and pump the stove up.
Yeah, there is that, right? Yeah. Like, and you are handling a cold tank when you have to light it at, whatever time, whether it be at night, in the dark.
Yeah. And sometimes that's tricky, especially if you're using matches, right?
Like,
your fingers get cold and they get clumsy.
Yeah.
So sometimes
dexterity is not always there. Right?
So sometimes the ease of lighting that comes with something like a propane, there is a preference there.
Yeah.
But equally, I mean, that's one consideration among many. And honestly, the thing that I've noticed most is just the teaching process for camp gas is always funny to watch because everybody forgets to cover the hole. Everybody forgets.
Why am I not building pressure in the tank?
It's just every time I push it down, it just blows air back at me. It's like I'm getting nowhere. It's like, yeah, you need to plug that.
Or they forget to open the valve.
Yep.
It's like, I can't get this to go.
Yeah.
Did you
open the valve? Yeah, did you unscrew it all the way? Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned this earlier too, but like there is something about the way white gas lights. You know, if you haven't turned a Coleman lantern into a 3 foot tall pillar of fire at least once in your life.
Well, it's about recovering after that, right? Like there is that momentary panic of
yeah.
The really impressive thing is when you can actually light a Coleman lantern with like, yeah, I don't know. What was it? We used to do this. Probably in Ventures, I would think.
Probably.
This seemed like a venture thing to do. We'd be like, how many pumps does it take minimally to light the lantern? So I was like, five pumps and then light it. And then, yeah.
And then pump furiously to keep it lit.
Well, no, but then you would finesse the throttle.
Oh, like, that's true too. Yeah.
So you burn off the gas, it would come down and it would kind of poof.
Yeah.
You know, do that thing. And then you turn it back on and be like, back to flame. And then you turn it down a bit and let it wait burn down. You did that a couple of times and eventually it pressurized itself and you're like, I didn't have to pump.
Right.
I think that was out of necessity in the cold temperatures. Yes. I think that's how we,
I mean, that is a very venture thing to find a way to, you know,
I think that's what we were
invest even less manual labor than necessary.
I don't want to light this thing.
Yeah. That's a vent thing. Definitely.
Yeah.
Minimum manual effort.
Minimum effort.
But, you know, it does work. Mm. So anyways, this wasn't really, there's not going to be like a decisive, this is totally the way to go here, if that's what you're looking for in this episode. But definitely, you know, I do suppose that for maximum versatility, your white gas is really going to be
I'm willing to go out on a limb and say buy white gas. That's my personal take on it, you know.
I mean, certainly it is.
But if you already have propane, you don't have to run out and buy.
No.
Replenish your equipment.
I guess maybe the takeaway from this is that, you know, it's probably good to expose your scouts to a range as much as possible, right? And I granted, this isn't necessarily going to be feasible for every group because you're not going to have necessarily the budget to have equipment that uses all these different fuel types. And it just might be the case that, you know, well, even if everybody's bringing their own, well, shoot, maybe everybody bought propane stuff way back when, and that's just what they got now.
Yeah.
So maybe this isn't necessarily an option, but if it is, you know, exposing the scouts to a few different types of fuel, a few different styles of equipment, probably not a bad thing, right? Because then they kind of have this generalized familiarity with a bunch of different implements. And that way, you know, they can be put into different situations and be like, oh, okay, this is this kind of thing. I got this. Mm-hmm. Not a problem. Mm-hmm. You know, my daughter now is in the outdoor ed program at her school, which is basically, you know, the scouting outdoors program. But taught in a school context. So she's already been crushing it at orienteering and she's waiting until they get to bust out the camp stoves. Fun times.
When your skills in scouting come into practical.
Hey, yeah. If you can walk out of it with a mark, why not?
Yeah, why not?
And vice versa, right? Like a lot of the stuff that she does in that class, she can probably backport to fill badge requirements as needed.
Yep.
So, there you go. Camping fuels. I did have a couple of little shout-outs and follow-ups.
All right, then.
So, I think... So, you remember when we did the knife safety thing? And
right.
And the author of the knife safety document reached out to us.
Oh, okay, yes.
And so, we had given him a shout-out in the Woggles episode.
Right.
For that. But then he actually wrote back.
Oh,
so just sort of a follow-up, which I didn't mention in the previous episode. He says, by way of further background, as the footers in the document show, this is in the knife safety document, Paul Young Davies was the principal writer and I was more the editor and consultant on content. We had been teaching troop wood badge outdoor skills and thought that a backgrounder for scouts with best practices should be available. We couldn't find any. some council websites and troop websites, if they had anything, they had a one-page summary of how they do the permit training. So we put these documents together and with the illustrations have been well received. I've never had any debate or disagreements over the content. You'll remember that I got into a bit of an argument with someone on one of the Scouts Canada discussion groups over the necessity of the permit program and whether it aligned with Canadian Path or not.
Right.
Evidently not something that Chuck has had to deal with.
No.
He says, I presented them at Scout Cons and at the Indaba at CJ17 in Nova Scotia. I share them with those who take training with me, and they have gone at least as far as Northern Lights Council, and they can be found on the PEI Council website too. Mm-hmm. So essentially the genesis of those was similar to that of this podcast.
Yes. He went
looking for the content. There was none. He made his own.
Yeah.
Awesome. He does also note, he says, we went on to produce similar skills documents for shelters, safe water. He says, Paul also came up with a series of challenge levels for firecraft. The backgrounders are not meant to be given to or memorized by scouts. They're for facilitators, who then sound very wise.
Yes, of course.
With the Canadian Path program, outdoor skills and use of tools are part of several outdoor adventure skills, but the permit program is not explicitly there, so it may be becoming less commonly done in troop. It was a status symbol for our scouts, where we taught, tested, watched them, and they received a laminated card on a carabiner worn on their belt at camp. Paul's home group, the first Stittsville, also initiated the permit pin program, which caught on and was later assumed by the scout shop.
Mm.
Interesting. A little piece of history there.
Yeah.
I may be the only scouter in those footers who is still active. Our in-person outdoor skills program for adult scouters is actually resuming as of September, so this month already, as a combined weekend of Scoutcraft 1 and 2, similar to what's done in other councils.
Oh.
So,
well.
Thank you, Chuck, who is the program support person for Voyageur Council.
Okay.
Just so we're aware.
Yep. Oh, that's great.
Yeah, that is awesome. Thanks for writing that back, Chuck. And sorry I was a little slow in getting around to offering a shout out again for the follow up. But, you know, good to know. It's interesting to hear, like, you know, the genesis of these things, right?
Yeah.
Because again, you know, this is kind of something that they whipped up on their own.
Yeah.
And it largely became adopted into the program, right? To the point that, you know, you can still buy the pins from Scout Shop. Right?
Yep.
Wow. And then also, I do have one more shout out here to Scouter Carl, Carl Grimsditch from Across the Pond.
Mm-hmm.
And this is going to make it into the Scouting 5 episode as well. But he shared a story of a scout there who was awarded the Cornwell badge for courage and determination. And so I'll cover that in Scouting 5.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, the Cornwell badge is basically like the highest award for gallantry in scouting.
Okay.
We have it here too in Canada.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought there was some crossover there.
Yeah, so this was a youth from South Yorkshire. And if I can pull this up here just quickly. Yes, his name is Kieran, and he's actually evidently only the fifth person in the UK to earn the Cornwell in the last decade.
Oh, wow.
He has a degenerative muscular disease, and I guess the award was ultimately given, you know, sort of for his continued dogged pursuit of full participation in the scouting program, you know, in spite of the significant physical challenges that he has to overcome to do that.
Yeah.
So we'll talk a little bit about more that a little bit more in Scouting 5.
Mm-hmm.
Carl also follows up, you know, just kind of, it's been a while since I've actually had a chance to chat with him. But he says that their scouts over there are taking part in a nice range of outdoor activities and meeting in their usual church hall again.
Oh, that's good.
The Beavers have a badge day set up and they're actually organizing a pantomime this year. It's a thing that they do in the UK, I noticed. There's a lot of like pantomime shows and gang shows that scout groups will participate in. It's a nice little fundraiser and a community outreach. The Cubs have an activity camp coming up. Their scouts are going on a hike and then a camp for the Remembrance Weekend to brush up on scouting skills. Mm-hmm. They've had evidently an influx of young scouts moving from Cubs and also a number of people new to scouting. So a younger and inexperienced troop. The group has had a lot of interest, he says, and they have pretty much filled up all of their sections. Looks like people have been desperate for things to do during the lockdowns, and they've seen that scouts were offering that, at least in the area that Carl's group served. And evidently, he and his wife have a little squirrel in the making. Their third child is due in February of next year.
Oh, so congratulations.
Yes, congratulations, Carl. That's excellent news. And yes, absolutely. I too hope that there will be a squirrel dray waiting for him or her. When 4 years old rolls around.
Mm-hmm.
I really wish we had that program in Scouts Canada right now. William would just love it. But there it is. Anyways, any shout outs, sir?
No, not off the top of my head.
All right. Well, then, of course, as always, a shout out to the good folks at Scouting Radio for rebroadcasting our episodes. At least I assume they're still rebroadcasting our episodes. I should really check in with Justin anyways about a couple of other things. But I assume they're still rebroadcasting our episodes. Mm-hmm. And if so, cool. Big shout out to them and thank you for that. And if you are listening to us on Scouting Radio right now, please do consider reaching out, getting in touch. We would, of course, as always, love to hear from you.
Scouter Ken.
Yes, sir.
How does one get a hold of us these days?
Ah, yes. Well, it will surprise no one to learn that it's the same thing that you can always do. Try to take over the world. Wait, no. ScoutingStuffPodcast@outlook.com or gmail.com. I answer to both. Of course, you can...
And Scouter Ken, you know. You can call him whatever you want.
Tack, Kayla, hey you.
Scouting Stuff Podcast.
Yeah, that guy.
Yeah.
Sorry. Of course, at scoutingstuffpodcast.com, you can leave us a voice message. Just look for the little blue button kind of in the bottom right corner.
Mm-hmm.
Twitter.com/SSYSK podcast, Facebook or Instagram.com/scoutingstuffpodcast. Can join our Discord server. There'll be a link in the show notes. And of course, you can leave us a review either at scoutingstuffpodcast.com or on, there's two or three podcast services that accept reviews.
Mm-hmm.
We're always happy to have those.
Yeah.
Add to our visibility.
Mm-hmm.
So
smash that like button.
Yeah. Well, apparently, if I was, one of the YouTube streamers my kids watch, I'm supposed to say smash that like button. But we don't really have that here.
Oh,
so we do have a YouTube channel. There is a YouTube channel where you can find all of our episodes.
Oh,
at least from about episode 100 on.
Okay.
But I think there's a link in the show notes. I don't know. Anyways.
Things we need to follow up on.
Yeah, things I
mental,
need to do
mental
more
note.
Yeah, so many things to juggle. But yeah, no, leaving a review is like, if you want to share the podcast with your social media circles, obviously please do that. But if you want to just sort of generally add to our visibility when people go to podcast services and look for Scouts related content, the reviews are how you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Because the more reviews a podcast has, the more that it'll come up in recommendations. And that is...
Yay, algorithms.
Yes. So there it is.
Mm-hmm.
Alrighty. Well, and on that note then, thank you out there for listening. And until next time, be prepared.